Hello, and welcome to another episode of Theatre Voice. I'm Matt Truman. This week, we're talking to the designer, Vicky Mortimer. Stephen Sondheim's Follies doesn't come around that often. It's a mammoth undertaking. Set at a reunion for an old Broadway review, it sees former showgirls mingle with their former showier selves. It needs a huge cast and a huge orchestra and a huge budget. Most of the time, it ends up settling for a sparse, concert-style staging. Not at the National Theatre it didn't. There, Vicky Mortimer delivered one of the most extraordinary designs of recent years, a crumbling, caved-in Broadway theatre with bulldozed brick walls and rubble on red velvet. Over 2 hours, that space filled up with ghostly showgirls, shimmering and sparkling like mirages. It was an astonishing thing to sit alongside. But then, Mortimer is among the most accomplished British theatre designers working today. She designs a wide range of shows. Her playful work on Emma Rice's Little Match Girl at the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse came only months after her slick staging of Ella Hickston's Oil for the Almeida. But if there's a quality that defines her design style, it's richness. The intricacy and texture of her work underpins that of her frequent collaborators, director Katie Mitchell and the late Howard Davis. But it's on Follies that this week's episode focuses, not least because your host is the critic David Benedict, who is currently writing a new biography of Stephen Sondheim himself and knows his stuff. So here he is at the National Theatre, talking to the inimitable Vicky Mortimer.
Did you know Follies at all when you were asked to do it?
I knew its repute. I'd never seen it, never listened to it, although obviously some of the songs were in my consciousness. Well, I had been working in New York when Matthew Warchus did a production out there, but I didn't see it. So, really not at all. I'd seen some other Sondheim shows, Into the Woods, for example.
And so when were you approached by Dominic to do it?
I guess that was probably between 2 years and 18 months maybe, before we started rehearsal. What was fortunate was it wasn't in an opera year, because those are the ones that can really eat your time as a designer. So I had time, and it coincided domestically with children needing GCSE support. So there was something very kind of synchronicitous about saying, this is the project that needs to be done on its own without other things crowding in around the edges. Once we were closer to production, and it happened to fit the diary perfectly. I mean, of course, actually, I'd only done one tiny project with Dominic before, Carol Churchill, Here We Go, which was 24 minutes and not very many people and not very much scenery. So it was our first serious collaboration. Not that that wasn't serious. It was very excellent. And I loved working with Dominic on Carol's play. However, this was clearly a different thing. So we did start work immediately.
So presumably you went away and read it and listened to it.
Yes. I mean, what was great about it was that when Dominic asked me to design it, he'd already talked to Stephen Sondheim and had come to the conclusion that the best route through was to start with the original script and the original songs. And that meant that we had clear territory. Because so often it seems that this production or this piece has been sort of dissected and, you know, reconfigured for each outing that it's had. So just having reliable material was immensely helpful. And we had a script and we had songs that we could listen to, although it's curiously difficult to find recordings of all the songs that we did in a format that made any sense. And that was the beginning of me understanding the complexity of putting this thing together, knowing what it was.
So presumably, when Dominic asked you, it was, will you do Follies? Here are the dates, and we're in the Olivier.
Mm.
And so then, then you have a process of you imagining how that might be, and presumably long conversations with Dominic about the idea, how you see the show.
Mm. And one of the liberating aspects of this was Dominic didn't ring up and say, it's Follies at the National and it's in the Littleton. Yeah, that immediately starts the conversation in a different area. And it means that because it's not framed in a traditional proscenium sense, there's no temptation to simply reproduce the stage of a Broadway proscenium house or something like it. It meant that we began by saying, what is it if we're working in the Olivier? And of course, what was great was it meant that immediately we were dealing with a psychological space that begins to support, even in architectural ingredients, it begins to support what the piece is about. And so that architectural fragmentation started to become very interesting. Dominic was really searching for the threads to do with performance, characters being on stage and off stage, being their presented selves and being their actual selves. So fronts and backs of things became very interesting, hence the beginning of using the revolve. And then the other thing that I think was key that Dominic brought into the conversation at the beginning was that rather than did the party guests arriving and their memories sort of inviting the arrival of the ghosts, it was very much the other way around, that the ghosts were already present in the space and they drew the party guests in, which means that physically the space is really owned by the ghost character or by the younger selves. And so they are the ones that actually lend their presence, their sort of identity to the space, I guess.
So that's a very primal decision that really dictates the world and presumably releases you as a designer, because it means you can be less literal.
Mm, that's right. And I think there were definitely moments in the script on the page which suggested that we should have different characters in little spots in different areas of a theatre, that you're, as an audience, you're supposed to understand are having their nostalgic kind of visitations in a dressing room here or in a backstage corridor there. But there's the sort of time is sort of concurrent, if you like. Whereas by doing it this way, we had so much freedom about how to tell that story of the relationship between the present and the past, and how the sort of reunion sits inside the act of remembering became immensely rich to do with the geometry of the space and how characters. Like, for example, using the revolve quite a lot in the initial party, it's about stirring up the psychological action. It's a sort of restless. The building is like sweeping them out of the way and sweeping them back into view. And so the building and the ghosts are sort of in collusion to make these present-day characters come to terms with their choices and who they really, or who they have become.
Talk me through the actual process. I mean, mm-hmm. This is a giant piece. Mm. On Broadway originally, it cost $792,000 and lost every cent.
Yes.
In this production, there's a cast of 37. There's something like 160 costumes.
Something like that.
It's massive.
Yes.
So, how did you work through the logistics?
Obviously those initial sort of rule setting conversations, which is kind of what we've just been talking about, are the first step, followed by unbelievable quantities of research. So research, what's great about those first conversations is that they suggest ideas onto which you tether your research. So it stops becoming, initial research is often hugely broad and wide ranging, and you end up with thousands of images that you can't remember where any of them are. So then you start to tether your research to different lines of approach, and broadly speaking, this production breaks down into the party environment, the past characters and their needs, and Loveland, the intervention at the end. So there are sort of three broad areas. So in terms of the scenic ingredients, after the logic is partly worked out by making an initial rough model, which we call the white card model, and the idea of that is it's a very quick and cheaply achieved sort of three-dimensional description of ideas. So bits of cardboard chopped up, stuck together, made into rough shapes and put into a scale model of a theatre, where you're just seeing, you know, does this work? And if we do this transition in this way, what sort of space do we end up with? And we were, for example, in this production, we were thinking about the sort of equality of space between what might be seen as onstage and offstage, and the relationship between the big bank of rubble seating, so the sort of what we think as the ghost character's own auditorium from which they are watching their present day selves. So there was a lot of experimentation, and that's already starting to get you somewhere towards knowing what's the scale of the build that we're asking for, and then so in terms of cost, but also storage, because obviously it's got to fit into a repertoire here as well. So it's not just about how the show works on stage, it's about how it works with other shows. Where do you put it? And then technical restrictions, such as the drum revolve has a very particular weight-bearing limitation. So obviously we've got two large pieces of architecture that travel on the revolve, and the exact position of where those two pieces sit makes a huge difference to how much weight you can put in them. So there was a lot of quite forensic work that was done, particularly because we knew we wanted to put performers on the staircase as well. And so we had to strip out as much weight as we could and yet still have it look like a solid bit of architectural detail. Meanwhile, there's all of the costume work, and that's a lot of spreadsheets at the beginning, and ideas about how the ensemble might be used at the party, for example. So Irene Bowen, the costume supervisor, and myself were constantly revising this spreadsheet as ideas came through from Bill Deemer, the choreographer, and Dominic about how the younger ensemble might be able to thread their way through different parts of the show. Lots of very early work with Bill about who's in which number and the costume changes required. Obviously that ensemble has their work cut out at the end in Loveland when the quick changes are pretty quick.
So the ensemble presumably are working incredibly hard.
Incredibly hard.
They must be playing multiple roles, because they are, as you say, they're the Loveland dancer characters, but then they're also people at the party and all.
Mirror girls, yeah, and the showgirl ghosts. They are a pretty incredible group of people with resources and stamina that are a bit mind-blowing. Not to mention the dance captain who's in charge of making sure that should somebody be off, she has to reconfigure super quick what the numbers are going to be with somebody missing. And she has a brain like a computer. She's extraordinary. So those logistics they have a huge impact on the budget and consequently how much we can make inside the building, how much we send out to external makers. It becomes a really integrated process between the creative imagination and the costume drawings and the detail in the model and getting the show on in the theatre. So lots of that thinking is done really early. So you hope that by the time you've got to the beginning of rehearsal, you can set the rehearsal process going with the performers, knowing that you've got a reasonably watertight plan for what you're asking them to work into.
And presumably all of this is predicated on what your actual budget is, and I'm aware that because Follies is happening in an incredibly resourced building where you have a paint shop on site, you have set build, you have all sorts of things that if you were a commercial company you'd have to go to outside. So in a way this is a daft question, but what sort of budget are you working to and how constrained were you by that?
I mean, I might not say actually what the budget was, because I think it's not, don't want to be evasive, but it's more to do with really understanding what a budget buys in a particular building. I'm very aware, for example, if I go and work abroad somewhere, that I can hear what the budget is and it means absolutely nothing to me until I start to see shows that have had a similar budget and I get a feel for what's achievable. So here at the National, when I look at the budget line, I also look at the allocated hours line, which, without getting too dull about it, is the number of hours you are given in each department to achieve the show. And it's as important, if you can, to look at that as to look at the financial bottom line. The production manager is enormously helpful at this point, because Jim Lever, who's the production manager for this show, knows the National very well, but also has worked outside a lot. So his way of looking at what things were starting to cost was incredibly creative in itself. And even though we had an initial budget which was somewhat increased once we got part of the way into the design process and it became really clear what the demands were going to be working with an ensemble of the size that we were and having an orchestra on stage and sort of semi on stage, and the consequences of putting Follies on in the Olivier. So it was increased somewhat. And there were definitely moments where it felt really quite squeaky and it didn't feel like enough. However, it was one of the most nicely paced shows creatively that I've ever worked on. Somehow the chemistry was just really suitable, coordinated, friendly. You know, it was just a lot of good fortune and really good people.
But also, I would imagine some shows, because of the way the rep works, because some shows end up not being brought back, some things are put on in more of a hurry than others. And this actually had the requisite amount of pre-production time.
I think what was really helpful was that it was completely understood from the very beginning of the show being proposed what it would take to put it on. Everybody could see this big project coming over the horizon, so there was no arguing that it needed an awareness from early on, and the building was really excited, the production departments were really looking forward to it, and so actually that there was a big positive support in the building for the production and for that process.
So presumably are things costed at after the white card model?
Yeah, so you get a kind of a very... It's an interesting moment, that, because in the past, often what has happened is that the white card, and it still happens elsewhere, the white card goes in to the production department, and as a design team, creative team, you can wait a long time, and actually your design time is ebbing away, and you're not getting the information you need back. So what's been devised here is that there's a 2-week limit, more or less, and sometimes a 1-week limit for departments to come back simply with a really rough guess about what the pitfalls might be and how much it might cost. So it's a combination of feasibility and cost. And that means that you've only got to wait that amount of time before you set off making the thing for good, and you can see whether there's a real problem. Yeah.
So you do the white card, it's costed, you get the go-ahead, and you start pulling together your research and dreaming up 160 costumes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And everything else.
And everything else.
And how long a period, roughly, was that from White Card to beginning of rehearsals?
I think the White Card was probably in January. We started rehearsals in June, I think. Yeah, it must have been June.
And were you working exclusively on Follies at that point?
More or less.
Yeah.
I did a opera production for ENO at the beginning of the year, so January, February, for which I was designing the set, so I didn't have the time spent on costume work. And plus all that opera work is done so far ahead that it fitted together fine. But once that was done, I didn't do another new production.
And a side issue, but in America, costume designers and set designers are almost never the same person. I'm interested that you did an ENO show where you only did one. I see you rightly or wrongly as someone that always does both.
Yes. I really like doing both. There are some situations where there is a very bespoke reason why it's better not to. And but there is a real pleasure in having a design colleague on a show in addition to the lighting designer, because we don't get to do that very often. It's always you sort of fall on each other with a huge kind of sigh of recognition and generally have a really lovely time. I mean, collaborating with another designer is always so interesting, and the conversation is of a different type. And there's something lovely about that. Conventionally here in the UK, we're a bit of an odd person out globally, which is that I think practice elsewhere is generally to split the roles, and so it is a bit of an anomaly.
You mentioned Paula Constable, the lighting designer. You've collaborated many, many times in the past. Presumably, again, unlike America, there are, of course, great lighting designers in America, but again, quite often lighting in American design feels like more of an add-on.
Mm.
I feel like certainly working with Paulie, that she's an initial collaborator with you. It's not and then we'll get someone in to light my nice sets.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I think, obviously, Follies is quite a gift in that respect. So Paulie's really, she's one of my favourite conversationalists professionally, and I love it when she's able to come in, and she very often pulls everything out of the bag to come in early and see what's happening and really contribute to the larger creative conversation, not just lighting specific, but really to understand what's the sort of belly of the thing, and that means that later on when you are talking about specific things, you've got much more of a shared vocabulary, obviously. But she's also, on Follies, again, lighting, like the building it's set in, is another character in the drama. You know, how lighting sort of supports the actions of the ghost characters and almost sort of forces the contemporary characters, the party characters, back into a spotlight, for example. I mean, one of my favourite bits of the show is when you get to Heidi's number. And really towards the end of, right towards the end of the evening of the party, she has the courage to just go into that spotlight and start to sing the number. Loses her courage. Then her younger self steps into the spotlight, and in doing so sort of brings the older character back in. And the spotlight is such a simple, simple device, but it tells you such a lot about what's at stake in that moment.
And it does seem to me, it's interesting you highlight that, because past productions either literally or metaphorically have put characters in spotlights all night long, and it becomes a series of turns.
Mm.
And actually, thinking about this, you and Paulie use spotlights very rarely. There's a spotlight at the end of Tracy Bennett's I'm Still Here. There's a spotlight there. I mean, I'm struggling to go through, I'm thinking the show through as I speak, but I feel like
they're
used sparingly for a very specific dramatic reason, rather than I'll show off this singer.
Yeah, very much so. It's really as if there's another ghost character in the follow spot position. And I think, so Di Boccia's, the beginning of Hattie's number is Broadway Baby is like that. It's a gift. And they have different qualities, each of them. It's really interesting.
And she has got follow spot in her lyrics. So.
She has. And there's something very... The way it works for Broadway Baby is it's like a poster image. And it's really cheeky. You know, there's a sort of celebratory, naughty feeling about that spotlight. Whereas for Tracy Bennett... It is about courage, and it only arrives in that real moment of courage towards the end of the song, and it's about lifting that woman. And then for Heidi's number, it's actually from behind, so the spotlight is throwing her shadow to us. And I think Dominic always talked about Heidi, that we talked a lot to the different party guests about why that particular character elects to come to a reunion. Why do they come? And for Josephine Bastow, who plays Heidi, she knows she's going to die. So this is just before death for her. And so that spot from behind is absolutely about reuniting the young and the old in the moment before she dies. And yeah, so they have a really very... They have definitely a psychological quality, if not a poetic quality, the lighting units themselves.
So all those ideas are discussed in the 6-month pre-production period.
Mm-hmm.
You get into rehearsal. How present were you in rehearsals? How present do you need to be if you've done a lot of prep in that earlier period?
It depends, really. What Dominic and Bill had as their process, which I felt really comfortable with, is a set of scenic ingredients, an understanding of the map of roles that were being played, but actually no fixed blocking, no real... fixed understanding of how this story was going to be told. We had a sense of what we could do with it, so it was like a set of equipment, but none of it had been storyboarded with a decision made. So that meant that during rehearsal I could be in a costume fitting and know that if I walked back down to the rehearsal room, the process was ongoing. And that was one of the reasons, I think, why it's so alive as a production and so built around the people who were in the room, you know, for this particular cast. And I think... So, yes, I did go into rehearsal a fair bit. I watched a lot of what was going on in terms of the revolve and the sort of components for Loveland and so on. A lot of the sort of smaller detail to do with the props environments for Loveland were developed during rehearsal. They weren't pre-decided. We had a sense of what we were going to do, but exactly what they were
An ordinary, very ordinary question. How long was the rehearsal period and how long was the tech?
I think the rehearsal period was about 5.5 or 6 weeks. And I think we then had something like almost 3 weeks to tech.
Which is quite long for this building.
Yeah. It is. And then we had a fair few previews.
Yes, because normally the National does about 6 previews.
That's right, yeah.
You must have had 2 to 3 weeks.
I think we had 2 weeks. Yeah. But what's great at the National in recent times is that there's been a realisation that for a new play or for a large technical piece like this, it's really beneficial to have a preview off, whereby you do 2 or 3 previews, you see how it feels with an audience, then you go back into technical rehearsals on stage, effectively for 2 days, because you get a whole day to work and most of the day the following day before you do your next preview, and it's enormously beneficial. It's incredibly efficient as a way of dealing with things.
What most people don't realise is when I mean, on Broadway, it's infinitely worse, but it's just as bad in London, that if you... People go, oh, well, the show's had all that time in preview, but the number of hours a day that you can work because of regulation is very, very small. So, yes, I can see that a window...
It's incredible. What it does psychologically to the kind of relaxation of the process. So everybody's free to have ideas and not just be problem-solving. So it makes it a really positive piece of work rather than just hacking your way through things that aren't cued right or... It means that the thing just continues to generate sort of a really brilliant spontaneity.
Which, again, is probably to do with public subsidy, because if, in the West End, if you took took a night off, that's a load of cash you haven't got from your box office.
Yeah.
You can do that.
Yeah.
I saw the first preview and then the opening night, and the one big change was the physical presentation of the... proscenium arch in Loveland. Mm. Were there, can you explain that?
Yes. So Dominic was always, just in terms of the original, how that idea came about with the drapes, the printed drapes, which is that Dominic had had a very clear brief from Stephen Sondheim that Loveland needed to be transformative. You know, that it really needed to have an interventional gesture into the production to that point. So eventually, via various bits of research, I hit upon this idea of these kabuki-dropped, printed, soft silk cloths, which were a series of cut cloths that went with these big prints of sort of chrysanthemum-like flowers and a proscenium cloth. To sit in front. So it's like making a fabric theatre, really, like this sort of ghosty theatre came in, but in high contrast to the sort of rubbly architectural quality of the rest of the set. And initially we dropped all the cloths and the front cloth came in, I think, didn't it? And then it whisked back out again for the beginning of the Loveland sequence. And one of the things that happened was that Dominic realised that the way in which the Loveland characters needed to invade the space... had to be much more active and much more sort of decisive. So they then all came on from the back and then the cloths dropped around them. And we needed to heighten the sense of separation from the rest of the set. So we made these LED legs, very, very simple, quick build, super cheap LED strip that just gave it a kind of neon finish and shut away the dusty theatre.
So it's absolutely, it's a tonal change.
Yeah.
It's not a, oh, that's because on the opening, it was on the first preview, one of the drapes didn't fall properly.
Yeah.
But actually it's about a directorial choice.
Absolutely.
It's not, we're solving a technical problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was about, it was this delicate thing needing to be confrontational in that moment, because it interrupts this interrupts this sort of highly charged argument that starts to play between the past and the present characters, and it's this heady moment, and that's what Loveland needs to cut through.
Are you pleased, surprised, thrilled by how the production has been received?
Of course, it's fantastic. When I recognise the quality and the integrity of the process that went into the production. It was a really heartfelt, seriously undertaken production of this piece. And sometimes you work on shows and all of that goes into a show and it's simply not received the way that you would like it to. And this time it was, which was amazing. Yeah, and every night the audience seems to meet it with an incredible excitement and generosity, and they get an awful lot back.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, to find hundreds of recordings with the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was presented by David Benedict and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum. Thanks for listening.